The Tailor's Guild is a work of fiction. Like a good story and a good suit, you can put it on as much as you like, and it becomes more familiar each time. Content warnings are available in the show notes. If you have a specific trigger, let us know and we'll begin warning for it. Now, settle in, feel our comfortable coat on your shoulders, and enjoy the show. A plutocratic elite. A forgotten working class? Machines powered by magic. Fine suits and solidarity. This is the Tailor's Guild. This was all a long time ago now, of course. It was a truly barbaric time. Farmers' fields were destroyed by infantry trenches. Towering combat marchers walked overhead, their footsteps shaking the ground. And above, far above, the deafening groan of Arrowkeel engines or the silent shadows of the war zeppelins. There was the endless, senseless toil in smoking factories, the dusty despair of the trenches, the thunder of artillery or the bombardment from Arrowkeels, the movement of massive shapes in the trees, unspeakable noises and the faint light of glowing orange eyes, and all too often, a maw of sharp teeth. Then darkness. The entire apparatus dealt death in generous hands, and no one from the assembly line worker to the frightened soldier to the newly dead, no one. No one save the wealthy bosses and ravenous generals knew why. The Woodland War was the end of the world. Except that it wasn't. The world didn't end. Now things are calmer. I wake up to sunshine and birdsong, not spotlights and warning sirens. There is the ancient skeleton of a combat marcher I pass every day on my walks, rusted and pitted, that is now home to a nest of rabbits. Children and shopkeepers wave to me, embracing peace that they do not know the lack of. Good. No one should live through the end of the world. That was our burden. But now the people are happy. We saved ourselves, all of us, together. The lives we live now, lives fit for humans, did not come easily, however. After the Woodland War ended, there was still much work to be done. This is the story of that work. I concede that there have been no shortage of stories, productions, art pieces, and speeches commemorating the workers' revolution and the myriad heroes who brought it about. But the workers' revolution, beautiful and grand though it was, cannot be understood solely through its public faces. The entire point is that it was a mass movement, a raising up of the common people. The folk of whom I speak were not impressive on the world stage. They were not heroic in any great sense, at least not the great sense that gets one plaques and statues. But they held a most crucial role. It was their blood, sweat, and fervent belief that saved everyone, that brought down the forces of capital, that ushered in this beautiful new age. Or, perhaps this entire endeavor is just foolishness and nostalgia. Oh well. You must forgive an old man his vanities. It started, as everything did in that time, in New Dawn City, the capital of United Tracia. Brilliant towers of steel that, they said, were emblems of man's greatness, rose above the barely employed, barely housed people who choked on oily factory smoke with its brilliant orange flecks. Nearly a century after the magical substance known as Quorum, the progenitor of that singular smoke, was discovered in the far north, bringing with it all manner of industrial innovation. 5 years after the end of the Woodland War, which had started when those innovations were turned to brutal purpose. The beginning of the war was almost an afterthought. A war was needed, and so one began. The endless forest that filled the continent of Gable was dangerous. The arcane beasts that lurked among those ancient trees were beyond what a sane mind could comprehend. We had been safe for a long time in isolated hamlets and small villages, but with the new industrial wonders, certain extravagantly wealthy madmen, or as they were known at the time, innovators and business leaders, sought conquest. More space for their factories, more dominion over which to rule. They looked at the forests with greed, and so the Woodland War began. Then, as all wars do, it ended. The Black Worm, the greatest and most fearsome of the monsters, was slain in the far north. Though the monsters rent steel and flesh and sanity with unerring ease, the newly expanded nation of United Tracia emerged at the end of the war, relatively unharmed. Well, by unharmed, I mean that most of the country's buildings and rich people were still intact. The soldiers and workers and bakers and families would use a quite different word. Those technological innovations that drove the war also drove peacetime. The smell of quorum smoke from the machines and the din of the factories was inescapable. So were the new appliances in every shop and home that could afford them, which was fewer than anyone bothered to acknowledge. So that was the situation in United Tracia, the year 831. A secure rich, a damaged populace, and a new world in every shop window. Ubiquitous in this era was the Tailor's Guild. Like all good servants, they assisted the rich in whatever they needed. Acquisition of a new suit for an event, the best dinner reservations, a lost sheaf of diplomatic papers. The tailors wound their way into every crevice of this newly mechanized world, delivering and retrieving things at the behest of their wealthy clients. And like all good servants, they weren't oblivious to the nature of the world, or their place in it. But that world no longer exists. We killed it. The black fumes that once heralded thoughtless progress have been permanently stifled. The workers sing while they build, and they, not their bosses, are lauded for their work. I do not lament the death of that slaughterhouse that was once called society, but I do hold the memories of my youth in my heart. The stories are worth telling, not for the instruction of future generations, but simply because they are ours. We lived them, and now we know it's going to be okay. It is okay now. We can rest. We can be happy. I suppose we should finally get started, shouldn't we? It was a fine, bright, cloudless morning, as so many of them were, when a young woman with dark skin and short hair made her way down F Street. All the important streets were lettered. She had the same air of diligence and consternation that the pilot of a combat marcher would have when examining a firing pin that had broken in the middle of an artillery barrage. Yaz, her full name was Yasmin, but she wouldn't dream of using it, had been searching for a good few days, and already she had gotten lost 6 times. She was new to New Dawn City. F Street was on Beauregard Hill. There were many hills in New Dawn City, and this was one of the nicest. It was in the West Terrace, a historic part of town near the wealthy estates and filled with old shops. The hill mitigated some of the factory smoke, but not all of it. The buildings were old enough and expensive enough to be well cared for, and were cleaned frequently. Yaz was in the right place. Stuffed carelessly between a Nedetti stew restaurant and a brand new appliance shop was a small storefront with a red sign. Ramos and Son Bespoke Clothiers, established 784. Yaz went inside. The bottom floor was the store itself. It was filled with sample bolts of fabric in endless pinstripes, Glen checks, worsted wools, rich tweeds, and crinkled linens, as well as the little cupboards that served as fitting rooms. Deeper in, sitting on a tufted couch and laughing about something, were two people. The first was an awkward young man with glasses and untidy hair, wearing a tweed suit that impeccably fit his enormous frame. The second was a distinguished-looking woman in a beautiful blue suit and a golden Edetti headscarf that matched the suit perfectly. She radiated a sort of calming, competent energy. The laughing stopped as Yaz entered, and she saw them smear customer service smiles across their faces. "Welcome. How can we help you today?" the competent-looking woman asked. I'm here for a job?" Unthinkingly, Yaz raised the end of the statement into a question. "Never do that," her father had said. "Be firm." The smiles relaxed slightly. "You can speak to Mr. Ramos," the woman said smoothly. "Follow me." The woman in the headscarf, who introduced herself as Zara, led Yaz through a door at the back of the shop, which led into a small, dusty staircase. This staircase led to a much larger, much sunnier room with a long table covered in rolls of fabric. A man in suspenders with an impeccably coiffed mustache and slicked back hair was cutting a lovely pink linen like he was punishing it. He didn't look up when Yaz and Zara walked by. This room led to another small door labeled Office. Zara knocked briefly, then nodded. "In you go," she said. Yaz straightened her shirt, second-guessed herself, and stepped into the room. She wasn't sure what she'd been expecting, but the office was a mess. Untidy heaps of paper and random swatches of fabric were strewn over the desk and filing cabinets, and a rather dated drawing of chrysanthemums hung on a wall. Seated behind the desk was a round and elderly gentleman with a much bushier and happier-looking mustache. He was wearing a tie with little frogs embroidered on it. Behind him, in the sole clean space in the office, was a picture in a frame. It depicted the elderly gentleman behind the desk and another elderly man in a soft brown blazer. The man in the blazer was kissing the man behind the desk's cheek, and both were beaming. The picture was blurry and off-kilter. It had certainly been taken in a photomaton, one of those automated picture booths. The man behind the desk carried an air of refined malaise. Seated on a stack of papers was an extraordinarily fluffy orange cat. She carried an air of complete disinterest. "I am Mr. Ramos. You're applying for a job." It wasn't a question. It was a statement. "Yes, I am," Yaz replied. "How did you know?" "The shirt. And the nervousness." Mr. Ramos's eyes sparkled. It was almost conspiratorial in a friendly way. "Sit down, sit down, sit down. We will discuss it." Yaz hurriedly took the seat opposite the desk. The questions began immediately. At first they were standard, albeit less like a test than most job interviews. "How do you work best? How well do you get along with others?" Then they became more obtuse. "Do you keep secrets well? Are you nervous around illegal actions? Are you a cop?" Finally, they got to what Yaz assumed was the bottom of all these questions. "Do you know the entirety of what this job entails?" Yaz frowned, searching her memory. "I know it's not just making clothes. It's also kind of like being a courier. Rich people need things, and we get those things for them. Discreetly." Mr. Ramos nodded. "Close enough for now. One last question. Why do you want this job?" Silence held the air a moment before Yaz answered. Somehow she already trusted this old man. There was a decency to him. "Because I'm not special, Mr. Ramos. I thought I would be, but I'm not. So I want to do something I enjoy, and I want to have skills that are useful." Mr. Ramos smiled. "I think we can work with that." The little bell above the door rang again, and again Zara and the large young man shot to their feet. This time the company was quite a bit frostier. A middle-aged man, with the look of someone who very much wants to have the look of someone you shouldn't cross, but hasn't quite gotten there, entered the shop. Zara began her welcoming spiel, but was cut off abruptly. "I'm picking up a suit and a parcel. Order should be under Cray, Arnold Cray." Still smiling, Zara indicated the large young man.
"Harry, would you go locate Mr. Cray's objects from the back room, please?
Mr. Cray, it'll be just a moment."
Harry stepped to the small door that led to the staircase and hurried up it.
Several racks with garment bags and tags occupied one wall, and a series of locked cabinets above held the other objects and parcels people might pick up from a tailor's shop. Harry located the suit easily enough, a thoroughly unimaginative charcoal gray two-button, then grabbed a key ring from a small hook nearby. With it, Harry unlocked the cabinet labeled A to F. He checked through the tags on the parcels, moving quickly to C. But where it should have been, in between an envelope for Crawford and a long, thin box for Davis, there was nothing.
"Sydney, did you move anything belonging to Arnold Cray?"
The man with the slicked back hair and the mustache glanced up from his work irritably. He had moved on from the pink linen and was now painstakingly stitching something pinstriped.
"Who?"
Harry gestured at the cabinet. "Arnold Cray. Irritable-looking guy. Middle-aged." Sydney looked up and nodded knowingly.
"That guy who tries to look mean but doesn't?"
"Yeah, I fitted him for his suit."
Harry paused, waiting for more.
"Did he ask for anything else?"
Sydney raised an eyebrow.
"An assignment?"
"Yes, a box from the post office. Something secret, he said, though I'd bet it's just some new shoes, which he clearly needs. The post office told me they'd have an M1 Lawrence drop it off this evening.
He said he would be back on the 37th, so we've still got a few days."
"He's downstairs," Harry said, wincing.
"He's what?"
"Oh."
Sydney paused.
"This is why I should always do everything 10 days ahead. I thought 5 would be enough, but these people simply do not care for—"
He stopped, thinking rapidly.
"Well, nothing for it.
Tell Zara I want to speak with her. I'll fill her in so she can delay him. Tell Bully Boy down there that you're going out on your break, then run to the post office, and we'll all just hope they've got it in already."
Relieved, Harry turned to go.
"Harry," Sydney called. Harry stopped and glanced back.
"Run," Sydney stressed.
Nodding several times to himself, Harry pounded back down the stairs. When he returned to the shop floor, Arnold Cray was complaining bitterly about the financial markets. Zara was smiling along, though Harry could spot her boredom. Harry relayed the message, and Zara was gone up the stairs in an instant. He began to head for the door, but Arnold Cray's voice stopped him.
"Aren't you going to help me?"
It was clearly meant to sound important, but it came out as more of a whine.
"I have to go on break, sorry. Zara will help you when she returns."
Arnold Cray's response of, "Archibald's wit, it's 3:30, was lost as Harry broke into a sprint.
Mr. Ramos indicated one last spot for Yaz to sign, then smiled at her.
"And that's it. You're official. Paychecks are every other Friday, and we'll get you started on training right away. Do you have time to get started today, or do you have other obligations?"
Yaz smiled in return.
"I'm ready to get started right now. What's next?"
Mr. Ramos heaved a theatrical sigh.
"What's next for me, I'm afraid, is to continue with this paperwork. But the good lieutenant is right out there, and he'll start your training."
The lieutenant must be the severe-looking man with the slicked back hair and the mustache, Yaz realized. As she left the room, she heard a sound like a cat landing lightly on the floor, followed by the sound of a stack of papers landing heavily on the floor, all accompanied by another deep sigh from Mr. Ramos. This time, Sydney did look up as she approached.
"Got the job, eh?"
Yaz nodded shyly.
"Mr. Ramos said I should talk to you?"
Again, that frustrating accidental question. Sydney beckoned her to sit down, then pushed aside the pinstriped mound of fabric he was stitching.
"Right," he said.
You'll learn the rights and wrongs of suiting and clothing and what have you in a bit, but let's cover the important stuff first. Being a tailor means, basically, being an errand runner for anyone with money. Sometimes it's a hobby that would ruin a reputation, sometimes it's just vague and hard to locate, sometimes it's just that the rich are, allegedly, busy. Most times, it's a lot less interesting than you'd hope. But what's important about all of it is that it's secret. It's discreet. If someone asks a tailor to do something, it's because they know not a word of it will get breathed to anyone. Now, that's not usually necessary, but nevertheless, it is the level of professionalism to which we are held. It's also why tailors sometimes get kidnapped. Certain people want information about what certain other people are up to in private, and we never talk, no matter what. Why is that, do you think? Yaz, caught in a sudden nightmarish vision of being disappeared down some dark alleyway, jolted. Because we need to protect the trust that our clients place in us? Sydney barked a laugh. No. If you're trying to protect some rich parasite who doesn't care whether you live or die, it's easy to give away a secret. We don't speak to protect each other. A tailor divulges a secret, and suddenly the whole guild is compromised, and those same rich parasites stop trusting us. And a whole lot of folks lose their jobs. That caught on a point Yaz was curious about. The guild? So all sorts of different tailors' shops are connected? Sydney wobbled a hand equivocally. Yes and no. The guild has representatives, and they contact shops on occasion to check in. They provide a framework for things and resources to fall back on if we need help, but the individual shops don't connect much outside of your normal, small-scale friendships and rivalries. Guild leadership also has a lot of lunches with those same rich parasites, so make of that what you will. Yaz nodded, piecing it all together in her mind. Then the door to Mr. Ramos's office slammed open. He was holding a rapidly collapsing stack of paper together with both hands and had the receiver of a telephone grabbed awkwardly in the crook of his neck. The telephone's cord was stretched out nearly taut, and he was indicating furiously and silently towards the phone. Yaz leapt to her feet and grabbed the receiver. After a few seconds of hurried conversation, she looked over to Sydney.
It's someone named Harry. He says to tell you it's a huge crate and he can't lift it.
Sydney's face fell. Of course it is. Let's get the car. It was only when Sydney reached behind himself for a carved wooden cane and set his forearm into it that Yaz realized his left pant leg hung loose below the knee. Sydney heaved himself up and set off at a brisk clip toward the stairs. Yaz hurried after. Apparently, there was another small door down the stairs that Yaz hadn't noticed. It opened out into a small alleyway, filled with trash cans and shipping debris. Parked unobtrusively next to the alley door was a little red car, a Whim. Whim knew how to make cars in those days. White wall tires, a white roof, all curves and sleekness. This was one of the inexpensive ones, although it had a big trunk. On the door, in neat lettering, it read, Ramos & Son Bespoke Clothiers, established 784. Sydney swung into the driver's seat, and Yaz hurried around to the other side. Sydney manipulated two rods that were connected to the pedals with ease, and the little car peeled out of the alleyway and out onto the main street. Sydney handled the Whim masterfully, avoiding the light afternoon traffic. One delivery marcher held them up with its slow, plodding gait. It was painted a cheerful orange, no doubt concealing the original military drab beneath. Yaz grabbed the Whim's dashboard in terror as Sydney veered between the marcher's four legs, and she saw in the rearview mirror the marcher's pilot, shaking her fist at them. Within only a few moments, they screeched to a halt outside the post office. The post office was a small building, decorated in the traditional silver livery that most post offices on the continent of Gable carried. Standing at the top of the smooth ramp that led up to the front doors, pacing up and down nervously, was Harry. His jacket was folded under his arm and his blue tie was loose. When the car rolled to a stop, he waved eagerly.
Sydney indicated Harry with his chin. I'll keep the car running. Can you help him with the box? In a flash, Yaz was out of the car. Not an hour on the job, and she was already helping with mysterious packages. This mysterious package, however, proved instantly frustrating. The crate was made from slippery plywood, and shed sawdust whenever anyone so much as looked at it. Harry tried to awkwardly carry it with his arms forward to avoid getting dust on his clothes, and Yaz followed suit. Whatever was in the crate was heavy. As they shuffled towards the door, the crate's contents slid towards Yaz and she overbalanced, dropping her end of the crate with a sharp, flat snap of wood breaking. The crate came apart. Grimacing, Harry held the two sides closed, covering his shirt and tie in grime and sawdust. The post office clerk, in a stylish silver peaked cap, hurried out from behind the counter. Following him were three little machines with elongated metal bodies and gossamer wings, each painted post office silver. They were M1 Lawrences, another repurposed piece of Woodland War-era technology. They attached themselves to the box, their little motors whining as they tried to lift it. Between the three of them, and the Lawrences, they managed to shuffle through the front doors, down the ramp, and lodge the offending parcel in the trunk of the little red Whim. Harry and Yaz piled into the back seat, and almost before they were fully inside, Sydney threw the car into gear. If Sydney's driving to the post office had been masterful, the ride back was positively daredevilish. They careened to a halt back in the alleyway, and Sydney urged everyone out. Zara was nodding along to something Arnold Cray was saying about financial markets, her eyes glazed over, when Yaz and Harry burst into the room, sliding the massive crate between them across the floor. "Mr. Cray," Harry said triumphantly, sides heaving, "your package and suit are here." Arnold Cray snorted derisively under his breath. "About time." As Arnold Cray heaved the box out the front door, the broken panel slipped for just a moment, and Harry saw from within the crate an orange glow. It was a container of Quorum. After that, the shop settled back down quite a bit. Zara leaned back against a rack of fabric swatches, breathing a sigh of relief. "Well, he was a delight," she commented. Harry shook his head. 5 days early. Does no one have any respect for us? Zara sat back on the couch. "Definitely not. Fine line of work you've picked, Yaz. Enjoying it so far?" Yaz was. Yaz was, in fact, overjoyed. She was working. She had a job, and it was a job she had selected and sought out herself. It was interesting. It was exciting, and everyone seemed nice. What more could she ask for? The actual career she'd spent her life preparing for, perhaps. Even one message from anyone. With some effort, she shoved those thoughts away. Today was not the day to worry about all that. Today was a day for appreciation. Ramos and Son Bespoke Clothiers, established 784, was quiet for the rest of the day. The minutiae of Yaz's training faded as the sun crept past the horizon, catching the tall buildings and the few new metal and glass skyscrapers of New Dawn City in a riot of sunset colors. They had a good view up on the hill. People drifted away as their shifts ended. First was Harry, with a hesitant sort of smile and a shy wave. Next was Mr. Ramos, a bundle of papers under his arm and a brief yet courteous goodbye, accompanied by his usual disaffected expression. Zara stuck around for a while longer, swearing to herself as she adjusted a rusty hinge on one of the fitting room doors. She too left, with a few kind remarks. Sydney filtered downstairs some time later to lock up. "Your shift ended 3 hours ago." It wasn't a question, but Yaz nodded confirmation anyway. He clearly learned well from Mr. Ramos. "And it's your first day." Again, not a question. "It is," Yaz responded. "You in danger?" Sydney asked. This time Yaz paused and smiled sadly. Not imminently.
Sydney mulled this over for a few moments. Well, kid, you can't stay here. It's closing time. See you Tuesday. As Yaz strode off down the block, listening to Sydney's uneven footsteps fading away behind her, she straightened slightly. She was going to be satisfied, she promised herself. New Dawn City at night, in those days, it was a sight to behold. The sharp water sea, to the south, would reflect the lights of the town, and the music from the little corner restaurants and excited voices would pour out over the bridges and winding walls. All the life and energy of the city flowed around, leaving a companionable sort of anonymity for those on the street. As Yaz walked home along the shoreline, it felt different. It was the start of something new. Newness is precious. That crackling, electrifying feeling of wide-open horizons and endless possibility is wonderful. Nothing stays new, of course, but that's not a bad thing. Newness doesn't exist by itself. It exists for a moment, worthy of joy, and then it moves on. As things settle in and become familiar or old, they remain just as precious, and their present states just as worthy of joy. And then they move on too. We all discover new depths of happiness as we and the things around us endlessly move on. There's a lot of beauty in the memory of newness, seeing what has happened from the perspective of a time when it was still yet to come. There's a lot of beauty in that old joy. I think that's all for now. Yours sincerely, The Storyteller. The Tailor's Guild, Season 1, Episode 1, Pilot, was written by Jules Blymore and produced by Jules Blymore, starring Jules Blymore as the storyteller. Original music by Colin Tidwell with Thomas Tidwell Consulting. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Send us a message at thetailorsguildcast@gmail.com or on Twitter and Tumblr at thetailorsguild. New episodes on the 7th and 21st. Thank you for listening. Join a union.